Welcome to Modcast, Civilization podcast focused on game modding. Gilded Duke.
Hamble.
With guest co-hosts.
Framed Architecture.
Classicus.
This is episode 48 with co-hosts Kevin Gilded Duke Bryan and
Mark Ford.
And guests.
Victor Isbell, Thalassicus.
Framed Architecture.
Now, I think we were going to want to begin with, well, Brave New World is out, and it has broken a whole lot of things with modding.
I've just been crazy trying to, playing it and also trying to get my mods to work again.
But I also think it actually holds a lot of promise for new things we can do with all the new systems. Mark, follow and cover, that one would be perfect to use with trade routes.
They broke with the patch, actually, so. But I should have them fixed, wasn't soon. They modified a lot of the Lua files, and so any of my stuff that touches like tech tree and all that stuff is it's got to be redone.
The big thing that always changes in any patch is the interface, and since a lot of mods do a lot of interface changes, that takes a while.
See if I can find the count here. I had the count of how many Lua files changed, but it's a lot. They're not hard to update. It's just that, you know, you have to get the new file, and then you have to basically figure out how to copy and paste your code into it and make a couple of minor tweaks if necessary in most cases. Sometimes it gets uglier than that, but
I wouldn't say that it broke mods. It's just that it updated the game, and when you do that, you're going to have changes that you're going to have to think about. I mean, like the addition of tourism, so you're obviously going to have to factor that in. And the interface, whenever they add tourism to part of the interface, that interface file is going to be different, so you're going to have to compare it to your own interface files if you're doing an interface mod, and then figure out what changes need to be made to make them compatible again.
Yeah.
To say that compared to the G&K release, this is not bad at all. I was expecting a more whack-a-mole kind of thing like we had last June, but honestly, it hasn't been that bad. I don't know if it's that my skill level's increased or just this was a better release in regards to modding. There were some things in the G&K release that just killed all mods. For example, some changes to the way culture was handled in the database that just destroyed things. And there were also some major functions that just destroyed other people's mods. And I haven't seen as much of that this go-round.
And also G&K completely revamped the tech tree, redid a lot of units. It was more of a complete overhaul, whereas Brave New World focuses more on adding specific new features like trade routes or the World Congress that don't really interfere much with stuff that already exists.
Which is kind of ironic, actually, because at least from my perspective, G&K's additions were almost optional, whereas the additions for B&W are really game-changing, especially on the trade side and the economy side. So even though the B&W changes, from my perspective, are game-changing, they didn't seem to break as much. So that's good. I don't know if they were thinking about modders in that respect, but kudos to them.
It's very true.
I like that even though it is billed as sort of an end-game expansion, you can start building trade routes right away, and I like that. I think that gets you kind of pulls you in, gets you going.
It's everything that was on my list of things that I wanted for this game are in B&W, and none of the things that I wanted were in G&K. So, kudos to the designers. I think they've really outdone themselves. Every new element from the from trade routes, which changes the economy, to the new culture system, which is a vast improvement over the other cultural victory type thing that they had. And even some of the smaller things, like the way that you can build the great works of art and music and stuff, are just really appealing to me.
In many ways, it reminds me of the difference between the two expansion packs for Civilization IV. The first one had somewhat of a smaller scope, whereas the second one really perfected the game. It's almost like with the first one, they're still trying to, you know, get stuff working. And then for the second expansion, they branch out and do totally new things.
You know, small pointless gripe, but I liked the old colors.
Are you talking about the interface colors?
Yes.
Oh, I love the new interface colors.
I've never been a fan of that 1930s Art Moderne motif, so I have to agree with Mark that I like the G&K version better, but, you know, who cares? I'm colorblind anyhow, so what does it matter?
Yeah. I remember with the G&K, how civs you had to add spies or else the game would crash. but I haven't noticed anything similar of that level with the new expansion.
Well, to any modders out there, I did something differently when I approached adapting my mod this time around. For GNK, I focused on basically doing everything at once, updating all the files, adding all the data that changed, and, you know, making the code compatible with the old interface stuff. But this time around, I took a different approach. I basically started back where I began with simple data edits, because 9 times out of 10, changes made to XML or SQL very rarely will cause catastrophic game-breaking bugs. I mean, it, you know, might mess up a few units or something, but it usually doesn't cause wide-scale chaos. And so if you do simple things, like if you're focusing on a mod that does gameplay, you might do all the gameplay features you can that are as simple as possible just to get something going. Because otherwise, it's a very daunting task to try and take on everything at once. So start with something simple and easy that you can get done and feel some accomplishment with, and then start moving on to more difficult stuff that needs adaptation.
Well, there's also another terrific change for modders wanting to make edits, and that is that the Fire Tuner now actually prints out the entire untruncated statement for Lua errors, which I can tell you has been a fantastic resource for me now. It used to be just frustrating to see a halfway of an error report, but now you can actually see it, and I've been able to...
That is amazing.
And I didn't even notice that.
And they fixed the game events bug so that you see errors in Fire Tuner that shoot off under a game event, which they did not before. You had to use pcall.
And that's actually more significant than some people might even realize, because when I inquired about the truncation of error messages thing, they said that was actually not in their code, like Firex's own code. It's actually something with the basic Lua error handler. So in order to fix that, they actually had to go into their implementation of Lua that they're using and change it at a very basic level. So that actually is remarkable. I had not noticed that yet.
Actually, that's important, too, because if they're now using a customized Lua DLL, you won't be able to swap in an optimized DLL for faster turn times anymore.
They might have figured out another way to do it that doesn't involve changing the custom Lua DLL. I don't know the details.
Be interesting to find out. Yeah, my struggle at the moment is the same as it was with GNK, which is that they have all these cool new features that I want to play with, and I have no documentation. I don't know how to do it.
Are you changing a lot of your mods based on the new content? Like, for example, is the Wonder Race going to change at all? Are you going to add like other kinds of race information in there?
Wonder Race, I'm probably the first one I'm going to finish updating, and I'm going to keep it as is for now, but I do want to do a BMW version. I have had in mind a larger group of modifications that I want to do that kind of work together, and Wonder Race would be part of that, and I'm waiting for BMW to do that. So what I might do is just update Wonder Race, follow and cover, and then back off and work on the bigger project.
One thing that might cause difficulty with modders in regards to Brave New World, and that's that anyone who's tried modifying certain things like culture in the past, culture was sort of difficult to change because it wasn't done as a yield. It wasn't like food and production and gold. It was its own separate thing, and they fixed that for Gods and Kings. But unfortunately, for whatever reason, they did not include tourism in the list of yields. So tourism is, once again, its own separate thing, like culture used to be. I don't know why they took this approach, because when you use this approach of doing it separately, you have to duplicate a lot of work. You have to have whole separate functions, separate tables for tourism, and it takes a lot of extra time for the developers, and it also increases the chance of bugs even on their end. And then it makes it more difficult for modders to do. I really don't know why they did that. It sort of frustrated me recently when I discovered that, but it's the way things are. So it'll take a little bit more effort to modify tourism than you might think at first. For example, one of the beliefs, pilgrimage, increases faith based on the number of foreign cities that we have. And I thought, oh, pilgrimage, you know, tourists. It makes sense to change that so that it gives one tourism for every foreign city. But you can't do that with the current data set. You have to change the C++ core and make a DLL in order to do that, which will obviously take more time and effort. It is sort of unfortunate, but we can work around it.
Yeah. From what I've seen so far, the ideologies don't seem that hard to modify. It looks like it's pretty much standard policies, but then with extra, you know, bits on top. If you go through the actual policy files, like all the different things you can select, I believe just functions as a standard policy.
Yeah, because that's basically all there are. You earn culture by a policy.
Right.
It just has a different interface.
Yeah, I was pleased to see that, because I definitely think that there's a lot that can be done with, you know, making new ideologies to compete with what you already get.
I haven't looked at those files, Kevin. Are you able to manipulate the layout of that tree and the way in which you progress through that tree?
It does look like you can adjust the positions of it. It looks like the new policies with the ideologies work slightly differently. You know how the old policies have the whole like grid X, grid Y system?
Mm-hmm.
The new ones have level instead, you know, level 1, 2, or 3.
Right.
And I think that's because if you look through playing the game, they don't seem to have set slots. Your first one could be, you know, one that might, you know, start normally be all the way to the right, and it automatically puts it all the way over to the left. So the X position isn't set with the ideologies where it's normally set with policies. Now, I don't know if there's any difficulty in, you know, let's say you wanted to add a fourth ideology. Like, I imagine it would probably be pretty easy to replace one, but I don't know if there's any difficulty in adding a new one.
Yeah, because each ideology uses the same interface. So
right.
You'd think that it'd be pretty easy to create another one. But
the thing is, like, there's the whole choice section thing. When you first build your factories or whatever, and you get the choice of ideology to go with, I haven't quite figured out how you add your ideology to one of the choices, basically.
That might be in the interface file itself.
It might be
hard-coded. One screen that will be rather difficult to change is Great Works, because it seems like the Great Works screen, where you can move Great Works from one building to another, that apparently is hard-coded, and it doesn't automatically check the buildings to see how many slots do I have, how can I fit this onto the interface. I don't think it's done that way, because like I tried changing cathedrals from having one slot to two, and it just broke the game.
It's obviously hard-coded into Culture Overview Lua, and that was pretty disappointing when I was looking through that to see that cathedrals always get X slots. And that's in that file. So if you want to actually change those yields, you're going to have to change the UI stuff too, which is horrible.
You know, another modding issue, this actually started somewhere along the line in GNK, but it's becoming more prominent now, is that they have a separate interface files for touchscreen.
For tablets, Mark?
Yeah. For Windows 8 even.
Yeah, I forgot that that was even an option with the game, but yeah.
Don't use those. I accidentally did that once. That results in some bad things on a PC.
Nice.
I was going to get touchscreen for my Windows 8 just to try and play around with it. You're saying it doesn't, it's not for Windows 8?
Actually, the XML just basically makes everything bigger, if I recall correctly from my one mistake in using that. So everything on your PC screen looks huge. Like all the text is like 4 to 5 points bigger. Hey, have fun. Maybe your eyesight's bad. I don't know.
It'd probably be similar to how there's two different XML files for a lot of interface elements when they want to deal with screen resolutions. That's right. Something that I always had to focus a lot on.
Yeah, like the CD screen.
Yeah, because I used to have a 4:5 ratio monitor that was like not widescreen, and so I used a different set of interface files than most people, so I had to try and test it out in other people's computers to try and see what it looks like on the other screen. So that's always something that you got to be concerned about with interface modding. There was one more thing about modding in general. Something that I'd really, really, really like to see in the civilization files that hasn't been done, probably won't be done at this point, is most buildings have extensive amounts of information on their tooltip that is written by hand in every single language that needs to be translated into. And what I'd really like to see is for that information to be created automatically by reading the game data files. A lot of the building information already is, like cost, maintenance, and some of the basic yields is just added there automatically without you needing to go in and change the tooltip. But then there's a lot of other information that's written in there very tediously, manually. And that really wastes a lot of time, especially for modders who might want to change a lot of buildings. You have to change the building, go and check the tooltip, and make sure all the tooltips match, and it brings up the chance of tooltip errors. But the odd thing is that it also increases the amount of time it takes for FireAxis to write all these tooltips, and then they have to pay translators to translate it into all the different languages. A better approach would be just to have everything read directly from the data file and just have it all listed out there on the tooltip. It was one of the very first things I did in my work for the unofficial patch, because it's just so necessary for anyone who wants to modify buildings to have a quick way to get all the tooltips updated. The code is not that complex. I don't know why they've never added it. It's always sort of puzzled me.
I'm glad you have. That's one of the things I loved about your mod, Val. Very good tooltips, better than Firaxis tooltips.
it's one of those really fundamental things with the game where if they did it so that it's automatic instead of hard-coded. That's something I've noticed a lot in several different areas when, for anyone who wants to start modding the game, is there are a lot of parts of this game that are hard-coded in a very specific way and are difficult to change. And then there's other parts that are done great. It really depends on what you're looking at modding.
Multiplayer maps. I do not do multiplayer, so I can't be of too much help here.
I've never played a multiplayer game, and I honestly don't plan on it. It's not something that I think I would enjoy, but I'm all for it. Other people enjoy it.
From what I've seen, just playing a custom map in multiplayer is actually not that bad. There's a couple functions that you can't use in multiplayer. Like, if you want to initialize a random number generator to the system time, you can't do that because latency in a multiplayer game causes people to return different system times, and then everything crashes. It desynchronizes the game. So you have to be aware of certain functions that might desynchronize multiplayer. But other than that, it seems to be pretty straightforward. I was adapting the Perfect World map to work in my own project, and some of the things that people have done to update Perfect World, because I think the original author of the map is busy with family and real-life stuff and so on, one of the things they've done to update it is to deal with multiplayer and make sure that all the players stay synchronized. But other than that, it seems like just pretty much you take your standard map, you just add a couple flags, check some functions, and then it's multiplayer-friendly.
When they get to multiplayer modding, they've got a lot of framework put in place for it, and most people aren't using it. I'm not. And it's kind of set up. It allows you to do that right now. Like, you can use functions that are not multiplayer safe or use them in a way that isn't multiplayer safe, and you don't get an error. But I assume they're going to enable all of that. It's probably going to break a lot of mods at first.
Well, one thing to keep in mind is there is a difference between network multiplayers, which is what we're talking about and most people think of when they think of multiplayer, and Hot Seat. It's actually very easy to adapt a mod to work in Hot Seat because it basically just changes out the players each time. You don't have synchronous multiplayer going on. My project in GNK, a couple people were able to adapt to Hot Seat pretty easily with very little effort. Network multiplayer is a whole different ballgame because you got synchronization issues and also people going at the same time, and so that can affect game balance. It's a little bit more complicated, but as you said, they do have a lot of the framework in place that would be necessary to make mods compatible with network multiplayer. And after all, the basic game is network multiplayer, so the capability is there, that's for sure.
How many people do you think actually play multiplayer? Is it a big community? I mean, I haven't really met anyone that plays multiplayer a lot.
It was really common in Civ 4. I haven't heard as much about it in Civ 5.
Uh-huh. I went into, they have like a finder. You can go in there and just the server that you can randomly go on to and look for, start a game or look for people that have games. When I was on that, admittedly, probably 6 months or so ago when I was looking, I really didn't see much action at all going on. But that could be that I was just, the default server is not the place to go, or I just picked a bad time or something.
I'm sure part of it has to do with the fact that Civilization has always been a largely single-player game. It's sort of like a certain other strategy games, which I'll rename nameless, SimCity, that tried to adapt to multiplayer, and it's really hard to make that transition, but it sort of works out pretty well in Civilization when you have synchronous multiplayer and people go, in phases. And it is possible to make multiplayer board games that are a lot of fun. And Civilization is basically a board game. It's just a very complex board game, but like...
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever played Settlers of Catan. That is an amazingly fun multiplayer game. And you can play it online too, I think. I've always usually done in person. But I think really with Civilization, the thing is that multiplayer maps aren't really too hard to make. When they do make mods capable to be played in network multiplayer, it'll just have to, go through and check the functions to make sure everything stays synchronized across all the different people who are playing. And you don't have any functions that cause drop players.
Yeah, they already have, network wrappers and stuff for a lot of their functions that you can use that'll take care of all that for you. It's just people aren't using them. So when they port their stuff to multiplayer, they're going to need to start doing that.
And also a lot of stuff modders probably assume that there's just one player. I know there's probably dozens of tables in the work that I've done that just the players whatever, and it doesn't have different players, but that shouldn't be too hard to adapt, I think. it'd probably take about as much work as adapting a project to a patch, because a patch changes lots of different files, or an expansion pack changes lots of different files, and you just have to go through and be very careful to check everything.
What's interesting to me is if it's synchronous play, then, you know, what does the active player mean anymore? There's going to be some interesting things to work out.
To my understanding, active player in the game currently means the local host, the client side. So if I ask for active player, it would return me on my computer, or if you ask for active player, it would return you on your computer. And so that would be something to watch out for with active player. But I don't really know the details. One key difference between modding in Civ 5 compared to modding in Civ 4 is that mods in Civ 5 are very modular. You can have all sorts of different things going at the same time, whereas in Civ 4, it's pretty much an all-or-nothing thing. You install a mod, it restarts the game, the whole thing is now the mod. And if you wanted to use multiple mods, you had to combine them. So with that is easier, because if both people are running, say, Fall from Heaven, then they would just both have that on their computer. But now when you've got like 10 different mods, I don't know how it'll end up working. I think we just don't have any experience with network multiplayer modding yet, or even looking at it to really know for sure.
If I install Brave New World, how do I then get back to GNK to, you know, if I want to keep versions going of my mods in both?
That's a good question.
Internally, each one of these is handled just like an ordinary DLC, like the one that added Genghis Khan. There are their own folders, and they have files within those folders, then it just overwrites the game's standard files. So you can enable and disable those pretty easily from the main menu screen, and it's under DLC, and then you just deselect Brave New World, and then it takes a little while to process, and then you're back to just regular GNK or vanilla if you want to do that.
There is one issue, though. For modders, you've probably added in the blocks and requires on the main setup page for your mod. And what happens now is that if you block BNW but require GNK, you'll enter into an infinite loop when you get into selecting your mods. So there's still a requirement on the user's end to actually physically disable through the DLC menu their BNW or GNK, whichever one you want them not to use. So it's a little awkward.
In the past, I also found that if you set up those blocks and requires and such on expansion packs so that it will automatically enable or disable them as necessary for your mod, that didn't seem to always be reliable. I sometimes encountered strange bugs. I don't remember what it was because it was a year ago, but it seems to usually be best practice to do that manually through the DLC menu.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, I have to say, one little disappointment that I did have was I was hoping that they would make it so that when you set up those blocks and requires, that it shows the name of the mod instead of some key number that you can't possibly
enter it.
Yeah,
that is very strange. It probably wouldn't be too hard to change on the screen either. Imagine it's just reading a string from the mod data file and you just read a different string.
Yeah, they do it for their own mods. For any of the downloadable content, it'll show up as the actual name.
Maybe they did that because if, like, two mods have the same name or a similar name, I don't know. But the ideal solution would be to show both. Show the mod name, its description, maybe, and then mod ID.
I'm Joe User, and I want to use a mod, and it pops up and says, you know, this mod depends on 73925 or blah, 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 whatever, you know. And I'm not going to have any way of tracing that down. I don't know what to do with that.
Yeah. What I ended up having to do was in every description, I put a prominent disclaimer, requires this other mod. But then that means that people actually have to read your whole mod description, which, well,
yeah,
most people seem to be pretty responsible about that. Especially since modding has been so popular in other games like Skyrim, and when you're trying to use mods together in Skyrim, it's often a lot more complicated than using mods in Civilization. Civilization handles it all right in-game for you, which is very convenient. Whereas Skyrim, you got to do all this extra stuff, and you really have to read the mod description. So I think that maybe if people are in the habit of responsible modding from other games, then it'd transfer over to this one, you'd hope.
Well, that's it's catch-22. The easier they make it for people to use the modding system, the dumber down they do it, supposedly, then the more this kind of thing you're going to have.
Yeah. Though, honestly, out of all the games I've played, Civilization has the best modding tools of anyone, mainly because they use Lua, XML, SQL, you know, standardized industry good stuff.
I've definitely been a fan of it.
I like games that use good industry standards. That's actually one big thing for me when it comes to coding is that I think it's important that you figure out a good way to code and a good way to organize your project and then stick to it. You got to make sure that it's easy to create and also easy for other people to read, because if it is, it's also easier for you to read, and then you're less likely to make bugs and other problems.
I also have to keep myself interested, though. So like in my project, sometimes I'll do something a certain way just because I want to learn that aspect. Like following cover, I converted it from its original form to a form that uses a more object-oriented approach based on some initial work that Howard had done, because I wanted to learn to do that.
Yeah. One thing that's really been on my mind a lot, and this is something that a lot of modders are probably concerned about too, is that once you've finished your project or you decide you want to move on to other things, other people will have to maintain your work after you're gone. And modding certain parts of the game are more stable than other parts. Like if you change libraries to have an extra 2Science, that's pretty much going to work no matter what FireAxis does, because it's just, you know, a simple bit of XML, and it probably won't ever get affected by any patches or updates or expansion packs. But there's other parts of the game that you change, like the interface or any core Lua files, especially Lua or C++, you change that stuff, and pretty much someone with decent coding experience has to go in and update that. It's always the issue of, well, from a user's point of view, more people are going to want stuff that doesn't change the game, like interface, adding new features to the interface or information. More people are going to want that than gameplay changes. So it makes sense to have an interface mod and then like one that does, you know, gameplay stuff that you can optionally use with the interface mod. But from a mod designer's perspective, the gameplay stuff is often a lot more stable and reliable and easy to code and so on. And so it raises the question of how to organize your project. This is always a really big question, especially with GNK introduced the capability to mod requirements. So you can have like one part of your project that has one set of modding stuff and then another part of the project that depends on the first part, if that makes sense. I'll give an example. In GNK, the way I put stuff together is you have the interface stuff that pretty much everyone is going to be interested in. Like you mentioned making CivUp compatible with network multiplayer. That's pretty much the part that more people are going to want. Whereas the gameplay stuff then has the interface stuff as a requirement. But if I'm gone another year and there have been other patches and expansion packs, and this is something that any modders have to be concerned about, how is that stuff going to fare when FireAxis dramatically changes the game?
I think good programming practices, if you've had any experience in that area, are good. You know, commenting things, leaving a trail behind for people to follow. If you go to the modding forum on CivFanatics, there are a number of tutorials and style guides. I think that you even did a style guide that talks about, you know, how to name your variables and things. So there's a lot of stuff like that that's important, because someone's going to come and have to, at some point, and maybe have to read that and look at it and figure out what it's doing or why.
That's definitely true. It's important, even if you don't intend to be like a programmer for a living, it's important to at least know some basics of how to organize things, not just for other people's benefit, but for your own. Because if you write a little bit of code and then you come back to it 4 months later and like, what the heck did I write here? I have no idea what I was doing, and you're trying to decipher it, and it just takes extra time. When it comes to adapting mods for expansion packs or patches, you want to make sure that you've got your project organized well up front to be prepared for those sorts of things. So you'll want to put some long-term thought into how is this going to be maintained after the code that it's based on changes.
Especially with a mod that is of the size of yours, is a lot bigger a deal than something like some of my small mods.
It depends on what you're modding, because if you're doing lots of stuff with data, like XML or SQL, that is pretty much stable. The data formats don't change much. There's a couple things that change, like the trade route modifier in one of the XML files is now land trade route modifier, city connection modifier. So those change. But overall, other than changing a few fields like that, you can pretty much carry things over after an expansion or a patch.
Yeah, I go into the XML and SQL only reluctantly, and usually for like language strings and things. I'm a Lua guy. I prefer to do it in Lua if I can.
Yeah. Lua does have a whole lot more power, though you'd be surprised some of the things you can do in SQL, in XML. One of the big difficulties with anyone who's just starting Civilization, I talked with a lot of my friends who I introduced to the game, as I'm sure we've all tried to get some friends interested in before, is that there's just so much stuff. It's like, okay, what do I do? What do I build? What do I research? And one thing that can help is having little hints of information, like this is good for if you want to expand your empire, or you want to grow your cities larger. And you can actually put all that information with some simple formulas, checking the different like technologies on the tech tree. You can do that in SQL, and then you can change the tooltips in SQL. You can do it all in SQL.
It's also my personal belief that we haven't built nearly enough of a library system for the modding community. I mean, we should have a separate section where this is basically, these are standalone libraries that you can use. People have, you know, written and tested for everything from saving your game properly to pathfinding tooltips, all kinds of things. You know, we can build libraries that can be used. Not only that, but I think that a lot of functionality that people do, they don't think about the XML. You could make some nice Lua feature that you add to the game, and you don't think about, well, how can I make this accessible to XML modders?
I agree completely.
There's three tiers of modding. There's the XML, Lua, and then the DLL. And you can really do a lot in any one of those tiers, depending on where your expertise is. I mean, people do entire civilizations added to the game and many other things without any Lua. It's all XML.
Artwork, something very important, something that I have very little skill. I'm okay with like editing photographs and stuff, but you know, creating icons or wonder art, that's totally beyond my league. And so if you're really interested in artwork or you're really interested in making maps or whatever, it's actually pretty easy to get into. It often seems to be the case that people are either really talented at artwork, the right hemisphere of our brain type of stuff. We're really talented at programming and coding and data, which is more left hemisphere. It's sometimes difficult to get both of those working together. Like, I'm really more onto the programming side of things. I know some people out there who do like new wonders, wonder art, buttons. There are some amazing artists in the Civilization modding community who are really good at artwork.
Yeah.
I think this brings up one of the themes from the last show that I listened to, which was about collaborative efforts and how helpful those can be, not only in learning from other people, but in just having people play to their strengths. Whereas I think one of the guests mentioned that they always worked alone, and I suspect that's how most people work. I'm an English major. I did no programming at all my whole life, other than listening to my mother, who's a COBOL programmer, talk about how smart she is because she's a programmer. And I never modded anything in my life at all before basically last year. Maybe I'm a good example of that. You don't have to be a programmer or have that kind of background to actually make some changes to the game that other people can appreciate. I mean, I don't have any delusions of grandeur that I'm ever going to be a programmer like Thal, but I mean, I do think that I can synthesize ideas that these guys come up with, these really smart people, and put them together in interesting new ways. If there's people who want to change the game out there that don't have technical expertise, then maybe I'm a good example for the kind of person that has no expertise but can still like gather enough information from the community to do small things.
Absolutely.
Thal, you may be one of the exceptions, actually, in that you work with a larger group of people.
There's lots of people who contribute ideas, and there are a few people who actually help with the modding effort itself. Grant, I don't know what his forum name is, but I've been working with him a lot. We did a lot of stuff with the leaders in the spring, and he's also been looking into helping update the project with the latest expansion pack. The hardest part about collaboration is finding people. Just like how you were talking about there's different levels of modding, there's also different levels of collaboration, because it's very easy to go onto a forum or a thread for someone's mod and suggest a few ideas, or say, this isn't working quite right and you need to take a closer look at it. And this often doesn't get enough attention, because having a supportive community of people who are all interested in the same thing, even if you're doing the actual coding yourself, it's really, really important to build that community so that you have people to give you ideas and help you when you're stuck and test your project. it's often sort of difficult, especially for programmers, because I know a lot of computer science people like me are somewhat more of a loner. But if you put the effort into creating a good thread for your project and really paying attention to what people are saying about it, that goes a long way.
Yeah, I think one mistake that I see a lot of people make, and I've even been guilty of occasionally myself, is that they try to get people interested in something before they've actually done it. It's like, you know, get an alpha version out, and then it's a lot easier to get a thread going and get feedback and pull people in. But a lot of people come on and they'll just post, I want to do this, and they'll have some complicated thing they want to do. And
definitely true.
But it is hard. It is. I am. Your effort with this community expansion pack has been one of the few really successful ones along those lines. Even if you aren't having a lot of people helping with the coding, you kind of are in a way, because you're incorporating a lot of other people's mods along the way.
That too, yeah.
You know, like Sneaks and a lot of the old mods that got pulled into the expansion pack. And
I know some of like the top panel stuff, Cal, came from a couple other people early on in your project.
Yeah, the trade area is modified in ways that I really like, but the original came from
Howard,
yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of collaboration that goes on in that sense, too, and I imagine, and contacting people and saying, hey, yeah, I want to do this with your mod and blah, blah, blah.
There actually are quite a few big projects that have been really successful when it comes to collaboration, like Civilization Knights, the Red Pack, I think Call to Power, and also Spatz's Alpha Centauri mod. They all managed to form communities of people collaborating on the project. There's also a lot of other big projects out there, like the City-State Diplomacy has been successful for a really long time. I always really liked that mod. So, in short, that collaboration is very important, because getting feedback from people, listening to their feedback, they offer different points of view that you don't have on your own.
I really enjoy working with others, actually, and I tried to get some community stuff going in the forums, and I'll continue on that, but, you know, it's not easy. It does take effort and time, I think.
It's very rewarding, I think, to create something, and then you put it out there, and all these people, or even a small number of people, because this is the first project I've made that actually was successful at all. I've made other projects for other games in the past that, you know, had a small audience. But even if you have just five or six of your closest friends, if you create something, make sure to put it out there or share it with someone, because the process of seeing other people playing what you've made and having fun and having a good time, that is very rewarding and also very motivating. One of the hardest things to do with any creative task is get motivated. If you can show your work to others and they get interested in it too, it's really a good reinforcing cycle. It's actually good to start small for that reason, because if you can get a little bit out and a few people are interested, well then, okay, so you go back and add a little more, and then more people are interested. It's a positive feedback cycle.
I've worked on one collaboration. It was terrific. I worked with someone named Hangman, who apparently had done an RFC mod for South America. I didn't really follow Civ 4 much, so I suppose it was pretty good. And so I saw that he was working on a civilization related to South America, and I told him that I was interested in doing a scenario in that area. And we kind of said, okay, well, let's work on that. And I have to say, like, he pushed me to do things that I didn't want to do. And I was so glad that he forced me to do these things, because it ended up being not only a better mod, but I think I became a more skilled modder. It just in that respect, and this was just two people working together, I think it was such a great learning experience. And at this point, I think I'd be willing to work on any type or theme of project with other people, just so I could learn more as I did in that project. It doesn't have to be something that I'm even particularly interested in.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of collaborated with you, Thal, even though you weren't around to collaborate at the time, because when I came into modding, I used a lot of your code to kind of figure out the lay of the land, because you had done and touched so many things that if I wanted to know, hey, how do I do this, you were an excellent source for that.
And as you mentioned before, I drew on a lot of and learned a lot of things from looking at other people's code. It's like Alpaca, and I've got a whole long list of people. That's something else that's very important, is when you do collaborate, make sure that you really understand and appreciate the environment that you're in. And you don't take people for granted. Like, if you're using someone's code, make sure to credit them thoroughly and give them shout outs. Like, if they're working on their own project, say, hey, go check out this other person's project. It's really great. I like a lot of their work. It goes back to building a community. It's not just you working on your project and they're working on theirs and, you know, you borrow some things. It's that you're working together on something that interests you both, which is, in this case, Civilization. We all have an interest and a passion for playing interesting strategy, thought-provoking games. Sharing that enthusiasm can really go a long way to creating projects. The work I focus on is two things. One, modding tools that pretty much any modders could go in and use. One of the really big things that bothers me about the core game that most people wouldn't be aware of, but if you start to get into modding in detail, you might discover, is that the yields aren't really organized very well. One of the things I really focused on with the unofficial patch is to create a unified, organized yield library that's easier to use and provides a great resource for other sorts of modding. The other thing I did with the unofficial patch is improving the interface to show some information that's either not there or sort of cumbersome with the unmodded game. Like trying to figure out who to trade resources with in the unmodded game is very difficult because you've got the diplomacy screen and it shows, you know, what they have available, but it doesn't show what you can trade to them. So trying to figure out who you can give your salt to or your spices can be a very intensive process.
I wanted to write a mod that actually would just do something that I thought was going to be simple, which was automatically fulfill I Love the King Day when it came along. So, you know, if it could make a trade that would give it I Love the King Day, then it would try and do it. And it turns out that is, as you were saying, not at all as easy as it sounds.
Yeah. And the code for trades is always also designed very strangely. Actually, all deals, all the stuff that you make a trade for on the main diplomacy screen uses this deals system that is very non-standard, very hard for even a programmer to figure out. And for someone who's just trying to get started in modding, even I try and avoid that. So what I did is I borrowed some stuff from Huard, his trade screen, and I basically just tidied it up, you know, made it a little bit easier to use. And I also changed some of the code so that it automatically adjusts itself based on the resources that are currently in the game, so that when expansions come out, it just resizes itself to any new resources that happen to be present. Another thing like that I did for the patch was great people. The normal interface has no way to really figure out what great people you have coming up. I mean, there's some information in a couple places, but it's really very difficult. So what I did is, on the top bar, I just put a simple thing that says, like, you're going to get in 23 turns a great engineer. And then if you click that, it'll bring you to the city that's about to create the great engineer. And if you hover over it on the top bar, it also shows other great people that are coming up soon, how many great general points you have, how many great admiral points you have. So basically things like that, that just provides useful and necessary information to the game that is normally not present, is what I focused on for the unofficial patch. Every expansion pack adds new things that really enhance the game in a lot of fun ways. Like, there are some things that I was very happy about with this expansion. When I was reading their description of it at the very beginning, I was immediately pleased because they talked about how they're focusing on making important decisions. That's one thing they emphasized in the late game with ideologies. You have to choose between this ideology or B or C. And that kind of important decision is what makes a game fun, because then you got to weigh the advantages and disadvantages. That's what Civilization is all about. Should I build this unit or that unit, this building or that building? What policies and technologies should I get? How I should prioritize them?
I think it really ups the replay value for me also, because you can say, well, you know, I can go through now and just try a completely different ideology, see what that's like.
I agree completely. And something that anyone should think about when you're modding is why you're doing it. The details of what we do aren't actually as important, because, like, if we change, you know, this technology to have a different building or something, well, that might change again in another expansion pack. But why did we make that change? And what you're talking about, replayability, that's why I do most of the work I do. Two really classic examples from human history about why replayability matters are tic-tac-toe and chess, or if you're familiar with it, Go. Tic-tac-toe basically has one strategy. And if you're familiar with that one dominant strategy, you'll never lose the game, ever. And if both people know that strategy, every game ends in a tie. So that's an example of a game where there's not really many choices. And since the choices aren't balanced, there is no replayability. We move on from that game. Once you've learned the strategy, it's pretty much a childhood game that there's no serious competitions or tournaments in tic-tac-toe.
We need to talk, because I keep losing these tic-tac-toe games.
Whereas games like chess and Go especially, because chess involves a lot of memorization in the higher levels of competitive play, whereas Go is very freeform. I strongly recommend anyone who likes strategy games go and try Go if you haven't already. It's a great game. But the key thing with it is there's all sorts of different choices and ways and strategies to play the game, and they're all very balanced with each other. And that balance has allowed Go and chess to enthrall humanity for thousands of years, whereas tic-tac-toe, we sort of lose interest in very quickly after learning the basics of the game. And that's the same thing I apply when it comes to modifying civilization gameplay, is you want to make it more like chess and Go so that it's very complex and with many different interesting strategies, and less like tic-tac-toe where there's one dominant strategy, one best way of doing things. For example, in the unmodded game, strategic resources are a really big difference between this and previous versions of the game. You get a strategic resource deposit, and then you can build a special type of unit in a limited quantity. The problem is, in the unmodded game, is that the strategic resource deposits typically give you like 7 of the resource, and then you get another deposit that's another 7, and so you have way more iron than you could ever possibly use. Or none. It's either one or the other. It's these extremes. And that's always been one of the main things that I focus on when trying to balance armies and combat and how we build units, is if you take the iron deposits and the horse deposits and spread them out a little bit more so that there's more deposits on the map, but they're all like 2 or 3 iron and horse, so you get several of them together, then you have fewer strategic resources total, but you're assured of having at least a few. And so it evens out the game a little bit more.
Do you get a real sense of satisfaction when you see an expansion pack come out and they actually incorporate some of the features that you've done?
Yes. The big area where that was done for this expansion was actually leaders. And it was actually things that I hadn't yet coded myself. But the community and I, we had this really big discussion about what makes leaders fun and enjoyable. Why do we like playing certain leaders and don't like others? And a lot of things that came out of that discussion ended up being in this expansion pack. For example, one of the unique abilities that we thought of is the Russians could start with extra territory for all their cities. We now see that with the Shoshone people. So it wasn't done exactly the same way that we had originally come up with, but it's in the game, and I'm really happy to see that because I think some of these new leader bonuses are a lot of fun.
They're definitely tailored for specific strategies, which I think is cool. There's no sort of overarching strategies as you had with Civ 4, it seemed like, attached to leaders.
Even small things, like you'll notice in B&W, they've moved iron up on the tech tree, which is basically what you did. I'm not saying they're getting them from you, but I've seen enough of these things over the couple of expansions that it sure seems like they're paying attention.
Yeah, it was somewhat more common in Civ 4 than Civ 5 to see stuff from mods like Beyond the Sword, included a whole lot of stuff from mods, a lot of interface elements and so on. I think part of it is they figure, okay, if someone's already made it and it's already a mod out there and people can play it, well, there's no sense in reinventing the wheel because anyone who likes that feature can use that feature in the mod. They could go to the work of adding that feature to the core game, though it'd take extra time on their part. In some cases, not too much time, but I'm sure that's part of the deliberations that go into whether designers add mods to their game or not. A game series that really did that a lot is The Elder Scrolls. Oblivion to Fallout to Skyrim, lots of mods were added to the core game. And I'm always thrilled when I see something added to the main game because it's like, I wanted this there in the first place, right? Because you're making the mod because you think, I want the game to be like this. And so if they then make the game like that, then of course you're very happy about that.
Feels like positive feedback, I mean, in a way, too.
Some people say, like, the idea was stolen from this person's project, but I don't think of it that way. I think of it as collaboration, like we were talking about before, about it's a collaboration between the players of the game and the people who are making the game, because obviously people who make games also like playing games. So we're really part of the same community when it comes right down to it, because the game designers are people who like playing the games that they make.
And all the modders are operating under the same set of rules, and they should understand them by now. Anything you write is open for a common use with basic courtesy from other people.
In Civilization, that's something very unique about the Civilization modding community, and one reason why I love it so much is because it's more of a shared, collaborative environment, whereas some modding communities, more if you make it, it's yours and no one else should use it. I think part of the reason why we didn't really get much tool development for Civ 5 is because the C++ source code was released so late. It was about, a year and a half after the game came out.
Yeah.
And a lot of the really good tools that you'd want to make are in C++. There's a lot of my work I've done that is involved because I needed the tools to do other more fun things like gameplay or whatever, or interface. And the tools were necessary to get the other stuff done. And about half of the unofficial patch involves tools, and the other half involves interface. And I tried to set it up so that people could use it easily, like you're talking about, like the tooltips. You can easily add new things to the tooltips through just XML. You don't need to modify the Lua at all. But it's never really taken off. I don't know why. Maybe we should get something organized like that.
Yeah, let's talk.
Yeah.
Maldiki.civfanatics.com is a great resource. Maybe it's not as extensive, but there are a couple of libraries listed there on the Lua and UI reference page.
You know, for some reason, I think we should mention that there's a new SDK beta for the World Builder available.
tinyurl.com/worldbuilderbeta, and that'll bring you right to the link.
I wish I could say, like Thal, that I have like some overarching ideas guiding me, but I really don't. I just have sort of whims that I'm interested in, and I'm like, I wonder if that could turn into a mod.
That's the way most people approach it. I think that's a very good way to get started. That's how I got started, too.
I think especially for a beginner like me, you know, you can't really undertake huge projects. You just don't have the programming skills necessary to set up a huge schema that you can work from. You don't even know that there are such things. So, I mean, you start small, and I guess that's the way to do it, right? You start with small things, taking what other people have done, changing that. I mean, I'm probably like most modders. I started by making maps because I just didn't like the maps that came with the game, and just moving to different aspects of modding that took a little bit more skills.
I agree completely. I started that way, too.
It's fun to do small projects.
I mean, I don't think your projects are small framed. I mean, how many scenarios have you done and, you know, complete tech replacements, unit replacements, and policy replacements?
I don't know, a lot, but I don't really consider database modding to be all that difficult or time consuming. Once you move from XML into SQL, you're going to become extremely fast at doing database stuff. And that's the one recommendation I would make for people who are wanting to do database modding is just stop using XML and start using SQL. It'll make your life so much easier.
Don't sell yourself short. I mean, I've done a lot of the Lua modding, and I don't have a clue how to XML mod. Honestly, don't. There's more to the XML modding than people realize, I think. So it is real work. It is real something to be really proud of.
Definitely. Even if changing the data is simple, figuring out what to change, that requires a lot of thought and effort. Like, how do I change this? How do I do it in a way that, you know, is effective? There's a lot of thought that goes into that.
And there's so many tricks people have figured out, like invisible buildings and all kinds of things.
Right. I guess most of my efforts have gone into historical scenarios, you know, like limiting myself by time or scope or region or leaders or so on and so forth. And just really focusing on a specific time and place. And that way I can get a handle on making changes that seem extensive, but really aren't. They're more like they're actually very limited. Everything from the ancient world to, you know, more modern times, like the Civil War scenario that I did. If I had had enough modding skill, I probably would have added random reinforcement type events, like what the Phyraxis scenario does. Mm-hmm. I tried to do a little bit of that in my Revolutionary War scenario, but it wasn't very effective. I think I could do a much better job on that now, but I don't really like to revisit my old projects. I like to do new things.
There's something, move on. One thing I wanted to ask you, Framed, have you given any thought as to how you might involve trade routes? Are there any scenarios from history or time periods from history where, like the British Empire, where trade was especially important that you might try and represent?
Actually, yeah, I've had a scenario called The Conquest of the New World, which is not a reference to Firaxis, but rather to an old video game called Conquest of the New World that I really enjoyed. I've been working on that, honestly, for like a year now, and the Revolutionary War scenario that I did was a spinoff of that. And I'm attempting to finish that up, and we'll probably have it finished up in the next month or so. And in that, it's all going to be Brave New World based, and trade routes are going to be quite important in trading with the mother country and in getting raw resources and gold that you otherwise have no access to in the settlement areas.
Nice.
I have a scenario that is sort of about global warming. It's not about global warming, but it's a very simple mod that tries to replicate global warming. And I do plan on adding an adjunct database type thing for BNW that will have additional world laws that can be passed to either ignore global warming or to address it somehow that would, you know, maybe limit, for example, the trade in coal and oil or, you know, embargoes like that. But just something small that will take advantage of the World Congress or add to the World Congress in a new way.
Like Alpha Centauri.
You could
pass resolutions saying, okay, we're going to warm the planet or heat the planet, and then it changed sea levels and other fun stuff. Since in Alpha Centauri you had elevations, but yeah.
Everyone with a coastal city hates it. Everyone with a city in the mountains loves it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was kind of thinking of using that great people, great work slots thing for something with my Mars scenario that would be more resource-based. That is, that resources come not from the landscape, but rather from people working in labs or something along those lines, and that the great people's screen would be useful for organizing that. But unfortunately, like we discussed earlier, it's rather hard-coded, so you can't simply just add new buildings with new slots, with new types of slots.
Yeah. You need to set up a system so that it automatically checks the data and uses that to create the interface, which is what they should have done in the first place.
Yeah, and you'd have to completely rewrite the UI.
Yeah.
Which is
unfortunate.
A nightmare. Yeah, that's like 5,000 lines of code.
Yeah, yeah.
My particular favorite amongst your mods, Frame, is it the ancient Mayan one?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I thought you did some neat things there with resources. Basically, every civ had like three free basic units. Then basically all the others required resources. You had resources like, what was it, meat and timber and obsidian and so on, and stone.
Guinea pig.
Yeah, guinea pig. Yeah, the Maya mod was the very first mod that I ever worked on. And that was in 2011. And I did some of the database stuff and just, I found it very frustrating and then put it down and walked away from all that kind of stuff for quite a while. It was a challenge. I don't have very good memories of working on that, and I don't really like the mod that much. But I think the concept of having like an ancient societies that chart a different course in history than that which actually happened is interesting. And I've gotten a lot of negative comments from people on other mods that my scenarios aren't, what's the word, realistic, in that they don't play out like a slideshow. My feeling has always been that a scenario is simply a starting point, and you don't really know where that's going to go, and that's the way it should be in a game that's dynamic, like Civ 5. So I think on the Maya scenario, it's the first time I really investigated setting up a historical scenario and then letting it develop into something very different than what happened in history.
I agree completely. It's all about giving the player choices. And if you don't have any choices about what to do, it's not really all that exciting to play.
Yeah, I've tried in my historical scenarios and in the Maya scenario to stay away from the slideshow, right? Which I think is a tendency, maybe if you're very interested in a historical time period, you want people to maybe relive exactly what happened, which events happened at which point, and so on. But I don't think you need to do that in order to give a feeling or a aura of that era or that time period. I think you can do it in other ways. Like, for example, having great units that are appropriately named. I think that adds a lot. And for example, or named units, that can help too.
Absolutely. And there's also precedent for it from lots of other games, like the Total War series. If you play Rome Total War, you don't have the same battles in the same order that don't play out the same way, but you still get a sense of it being rooted in history, even if it doesn't exactly mimic history.
Yeah.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com. For more information on Modcast or sibling shows Polycast, Revcast, Turncast, or about Polycast in general, log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
My family doesn't like to talk about Civ modding. Imagine that.
Yeah. I've always had difficulty talking with
them. They think I'm rather obsessive. They think I'm obsessive weird about this. I'm like, you know, okay, you spend a couple hours a week building ships and bottles or doing this. You know, it's a hobby.
Yeah, I am going to obsess over something. So, you know, if it wasn't this, it would be something else.
I guess it's better than square dancing.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Well, if you're a square dancer, you probably don't think that.
All right.
Thanks for inviting me, Kevin.
I'm glad everyone could make it.
Thank you.
That was Modcast episode 48.
Night all. Sal, can I take advantage of you for a second while I have you here? Oh, Jesus. Now I got distracted by what Kevin was talking about. I'll circle back to it. Go ahead, Kevin.
Okay. Let's see. If I might pause for a moment, I think I'm going to head out to try to pick up my car. I mentioned this before, but if you guys want to, you know, just keep talking, throw that into the Gods and Kings discussion, that might be good. But hopefully...
Brave New World is discussed.
Brave New World.
Yes.
The new one, yeah. you know which one I'm talking about.
The expansion pack.
The expansion pack.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gods and Kings remains first in our hearts.
It does.
Sorry, I had some kitten aggro. I missed a few seconds.
My cat always likes jumping up on my computer when he wants attention. Then he sits himself down on my keyboard. It's like, pay attention to me.
We got a new kitten, and she's great, but she's, you know, a lot of energy. She gets into everything.
If there is a modder who wants to do something like that, or I don't know. Point being, I don't know where I'm going with this.
Yeah. So do we want to finally get to frame architecture here?
Finally?
Well, it's been a while. He's been patient.
Yeah.
I'm just enjoying the conversation.
It's interesting that you mentioned narrative. I don't know if you played Alpha Centauri.
Yes. Alpha Centauri is a wonderful thing.
It's like a voice from above, Kevin.
Yes, I have returned. It is quite a story that has nothing to do with Civ, but... not long ago, I was running through a creek, so I got my car, though, but yes.
Yay. Yeah, I suppose we sort of wandered into this topic.
It's the best way to get there.
Yeah.
Record date, July 15th, 2013.
Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive.
Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.